And it's my great pleasure to introduce one of the rock stars of our community. And Chris Mathagon is going to talk about what he knows best, fast soluble vitamins, interactions, ancestral perspective.
Thank you so much, everybody. Thank you for coming to my talk. So what I'm going to, can everyone hear me okay? Is this a decent volume? Clarity? So the basic thrust of my talk today is going to be about the popularity of vitamin D and vitamin D supplementation and how there's been far too much emphasis on measuring serum 25-hydroxyvitamin D as a marker of vitamin D status, trying to find the optimal level without acknowledging the limitations of that approach and without acknowledging the important nutrient interactions. And I'm going to advocate sort of shifting the balance towards looking at nutrient density and nutrient balance. Vitamin D is an extremely popular topic in the ancestral health movement, especially because of where we obtain it from. So vitamin D can be obtained primarily from sunshine, although fatty fish and cod liver oil or other fish liver oils are also good sources. And so this makes it extremely interesting to people interested in ancestral health simply because of the widespread and sensible idea that we are exposed to the sun much less often in our modern world than we would otherwise be. And have been for our history, simply because we work primarily indoors, we wear more clothing, et cetera, et cetera. One of the main interests among people within, one of the main interests in vitamin D in the ancestral health movement is the role that vitamin D may have played during human evolution, particularly in driving skin color. Although this is a popular idea, and often stated as fact almost, it's actually highly controversial in the scientific literature. So one of the primary opponents of this idea, Ashley Robbins, recently updated his case in 2009 and argued that vitamin D requirements couldn't possibly have driven the evolution of skin color for several reasons. One of them being that although dark skin reduces the ability to synthesize vitamin D when exposed to smaller amounts of ultraviolet radiation, with the amounts of ultraviolet radiation that humans would have been exposed to earlier in our history, the dark skin wouldn't have made a difference. And also that the harms of vitamin D deficiency, like rickets, or the narrowing of the pelvis, are so rare that they couldn't possibly have enough selective power to drive the evolution of skin color. This elicited several responses. Among them was this paper by Chaplin and Jablonski, who are longtime proponents of the vitamin D hypothesis. And they basically refuted all of Robin's claims. Another paper by Bjorn basically narrowed in and argued that some of the conflicting studies on whether African Americans or people with dark skin in general really do have reduced capacity to synthesize vitamin D could be explained because the studies showing no difference between people with dark skin and light skin all used UV radiation that was much shorter wavelength was actually experienced in the sun. And then finally, most recently, Elias and Williams published a paper in which they not only supported Robin's original refutation in 2009 of the vitamin D hypothesis, but they expanded it, and then they argued for a completely different view of the evolution of skin color, meaning that dark skin evolved not so much to protect against sun damage, but to support the barrier in the skin to protect against infection and to protect against water loss, and argued that the loss of skin color was simply driven by the lack of need outside the tropics for such protection against infection and water loss. And they argued that simply conservation of energy requirements would drive lighter skin. So it's completely beyond the scope of my talk today to try to distinguish between these various arguments. But it does set an interesting context and background to my talk, simply because of the controversy over the role of vitamin D in human evolution. What I'd rather focus on my talk is a topic that's much more central to the question of how much vitamin D do we need, and how does it interact with other nutrients. And this is what I would call the negate hypothesis of optimal serum 25-hydroxyvitamin D concentrations. So if you do a Google search for negate and vitamin D, the most common author you'll see is Michael B., a highly respected vitamin D researcher who uses the phrase frequently. And the most recent example is shown above. So he says, during the evolution of our species, requirements for vitamin D are satisfied by the life of the naked ape in the environment for which its genome is optimized through natural selection. The Horn of Africa was the original natural environment for the species, Homo sapiens. Our genome, our physiology, and hence our vitamin D requirement are not thought to have changed in the past 100,000 years. Since early human evolution occurred under UV-rich conditions, typical 25-hydroxyvitamin D concentrations were surely higher than 100 nanomoles per liter, which is 40 nanograms per milliliter. Levels like this are now seen in lifeguards, farmers, or people who suntan. Since our genome was selected under these conditions through evolution, it should be evident that our biology was optimized for a vitamin D supply that is far higher than we currently regard as normal. If you look at the most popularly cited example of what I would call the naked ape hypothesis, it goes back to a 1999 paper that he wrote in which he made similar arguments and presented more specific data. So in this paper he wrote, many arguments favoring higher intakes of calcium and other nutrients have been based on evidence that the diets of prehistoric humans. Likewise, the circulating 25-hydroxyvitamin D concentrations of early humans were surely far higher than what is now regarded as normal. Humans evolved as naked apes in tropical Africa. The full body surface of our ancestors was exposed to the sunlight daily. Serum 25-OHD concentrations of people living or working in sun-rich environments are summarized in Table 1. And you can see if you look at Table 1, which I've reproduced here, that the data come from hospital personnel and farmers in Puerto Rico and lifeguards in St. Louis, Missouri, and in Israel. And you can see on the right that we have a range from about 40 to 65 nanograms per milliliter in these people living and working in sun-rich conditions. So as a little bit of background, I'll go into the biochemistry a little bit more later in the talk, but 25-hydroxyvitamin D is a metabolite of vitamin D that's measured in the serum as a marker of nutritional vitamin D status. And as I'll show later, it's actually much more difficult to interpret than that. But for the time being, I'll take it for granted that 25-hydroxyvitamin D is actually a good marker for a specific marker of vitamin D status while we consider the other assumptions underlying the basic hypothesis here. Veith is not the only vitamin D researcher who uses this same approach. Dr. Robert Keeney, another very respected vitamin D researcher, has made a similar argument, even though he doesn't use the phrase the naked ape, but it's essentially the same hypothesis. And in his response to the Institute of Medicine's most recent guidelines on vitamin D, he wrote, I believe that the presumption of adequacy should rest with vitamin D intakes needed to achieve the serum 25-hydroxyvitamin D values, i.e. 40 to 60 nanograms per milliliter, that prevail during the evolution of human physiology. Correspondingly, the burden of proof should fall on those maintaining that there is no preventable disease or dysfunction at lower levels. The IOM has not met that standard. And referencing 40 to 60 nanograms per milliliter, he seems to have been relying on this or similar data. Dr. Michael Hollick, another highly respected vitamin D researcher, initially responded to the IOM report with a more conservative statement that there was good scientific evidence that 30 nanograms per milliliter or more is necessary for optimal health. Although Keeney and Hollick later co-authored a paper together where they criticized the IOM report, in which they basically reproduced this same argument, except they expanded the range from 40 to 80 nanograms per milliliter. Although this seems like an incredibly sensible and even appealing approach, especially to people with an interest in ancestral health, it actually relies on a number of hidden assumptions that are highly questionable. So if we're to use the phrase naked ape with respect to sun exposure and vitamin D status, the implication is that somewhere between the loss of fur and the gain of clothing, there existed a period of time where humans could be described as naked apes, in which they lacked fur and clothing together. And that during this time is when the requirement for 25-hydroxyvitamin D was essentially fixed into the human genome. And this further assumes that as a proxy to try to understand what ancestral 25-hydroxyvitamin D status was, we can use modern populations like lifeguards in Israel or Missouri and measure their 25-hydroxyvitamin D and assume that it reflects ancestral levels because they're exposed to maximal amounts of sun. These assumptions are deeply problematic for several reasons. So one of the most recent estimates of when clothing was developed came from a paper where they looked at when head lice and clothing lice seem to have diverged based on genetic data. I'm personally skeptical about data based on genetic molecular plots like this, but if we take this at face value, they seem to have suggested that probably about 170,000 years ago was the time when head lice and clothing lice diverged, and that seems to indicate that clothing was in widespread use by that time. They also compared this finding to other data. As a reference, it's believed that body hair was lost about 1.2 million years ago. The first evidence for hide scrapers appears about 780,000 years ago, and that could have been used for clothing, or the animal hides could have been used for shelter, so it's not completely unambiguous evidence for clothing. And then 40,000 years ago, we have the first evidence of tailored clothing, which is more intricate and advanced forms of clothing. So it's possible that between 1.2 million years ago and 170,000 years ago, perhaps, that there was a period where early humans and our ancestors could be described as naked apes. Although this dates back through most of the history of anatomically modern humans. But there's another problem here, which is that genetic analysis also suggests that the development of dark skin pigmentation dates back also to about 1.2 million years ago, which is the same time at which the loss of body hair is dated to. So this suggests that humans are our ancestors who were never truly naked, in the sense that we were always clothed either with dark skin or with body hair, both of which would protect against ultraviolet radiation and presumably reduce the rate of vitamin D synthesis. Moreover, clothing is not the only thing that humans would wear on their bodies. We can look at archaeological evidence of the use of colored pigments, for example. And in a paper in 2002, Lawrence Barham, an expert on this topic, said that Central and East African hominids had incorporated color into their lives, by which he means pigments, to use for decorative purposes, by 270,000 years ago. And this addition to their behavioral record card would remain a feature of the African archaeological record in the historical present. Now, we don't know what humans were doing with the pigments, but it's quite possible that they were using them on their bodies, because if we look at the use of pigments in Africa today, we see, for example, extensive use of body paint, and here are pictured some Maasai who are using body paint for ritual purposes. If they were using body paints, we don't know how often they were using them, and so on, but it's quite possible that this was an additional covering to the human skin. Furthermore, it's quite possible that early humans used botanical sunscreens. Weston Price noted among the Pacific Islands that in several of the Pacific Islands that he visited, regulatory measures had been adopted, inspired by the missionaries, requiring the covering of the body. And he said that this regulation had greatly reduced the primitive practice of coating the surface of the body with coconut oil, which had the effect of absorbing the ultraviolet rays, preventing injury from the tropical sun. And the coating of the oil also enabled them to shed the rain, which was frequently torrential. And I don't know of any studies where they looked at the SPF of coconut oil or assessed the effect on vitamin D status of spreading it on the skin. But I do know that coconut oil, especially virgin coconut oil, contains polyphenols that absorb ultraviolet light, including ultraviolet light, in the region that promotes vitamin D synthesis. So presumably this practice, which Price is saying was almost universal in the Pacific Islands until colonization, would have reduced vitamin D status in those people. And so it's possible that this or other practices using botanical sunscreens were used by early humans. And in fact, it's interesting because there's some evidence that UVB radiation causes plants to synthesize more compounds that protect against UVB radiation, which means that even with climate variation, when there's more UVB radiation, using natural plant products as sunscreens is going to be more effective than in periods of lighter UVB radiation, which could essentially contribute to a sort of normalization of skin protection simply by using what's naturally available in the environment. So if we turn back to the basic hypothesis that we're looking at, we could say that it appears that we really shouldn't refer to early humans as naked apes when we're trying to describe their presumed vitamin D status. Because humans would have been clothed in at least darkly pigmented skin, if not clothing, perhaps body paint, botanical sunscreens, and whatever else we could possibly imagine, since we know so little from that era. So the next question is, even if they weren't naked apes, to what extent can we estimate 25-hydroxyvitamin D of that time period by looking at people in modern sun-rich environments such as these modern lifeguards? Even this remains questionable on a number of other grounds. For example, we know that historically, early humans inhabited a colder earth than we currently have. This is data that might be a little confusing because it goes back in time over to the right, so we're starting at present on the left. This is data of average temperatures that was reconstructed using data harvested from Antarctic ice cores. And you can see that over the history of anatomically modern humans, compared to the present, most of this time period was considerably colder. And so all these dips are basically glacial periods, with the exception of this interglacial period here. Now, trying to estimate UVB radiation that people would experience on the surface of the Earth from data like this is almost impossible for a number of reasons. One is that when there's more ice on the ground, there's more reflection of UVB light. However, in Africa, even during these glacial periods, there wasn't ice on the ground. So even during the glacial periods, that ice might be irrelevant to what we think of as the primary early human history.
On top of this, the data from this very paper indicated that aerosols from sea salt were 3 to 4 times higher during the colder periods, and that aerosols from dust were up to 20,000 times higher, and aerosols are known to decrease UVB radiation. Further, there are conflicting effects on the relationship between the Earth and the Sun on UVB radiation. So paradoxically, when solar activity is higher, there's actually less UVB, because there's more UVC, which stimulates the ozone production, which blocks the UVB radiation. However, these glacial cycles are thought to be primarily mediated by the changes in the Earth's orbit, wobble, and tilt. And those effects are more likely to lessen the impact of UVB radiation during these periods. To date, there is no fine-tuned estimation of UVB radiation experienced in the Earth's surface over this period. However, I discussed this with Barry Lomax, who's a paleoclimatologist at the University of Nottingham, and he suggested to me in our discussion that it would be reasonable to make a tentative assumption that UVB radiation was probably lower during the colder periods and possibly higher than it is now during some of the warmer periods, which would suggest that overall UVB radiation was lower during this period. However, on a much more positive note, he also informed me that he just received funding to reconstruct UVB radiation over the past 500,000 years, and then in the next year or so, if all goes well, we might see some actual data on this and have a much better way to estimate it. But what we can say for now is that we should not assume that current UVB radiation levels are similar to what they were in past climates, regardless of whether they were higher or lower. So there really isn't any good proxy for vitamin D status 200,000 years ago, simply because the climate is different. Moreover, there are some other differences between lifeguards and what we would expect to be our ancestors living in Africa. These include both their skin color and their behavior. So a paper in the 1990s that was looking at adaptations to preserve water, which would be important in an African savanna that experiences periodic dry periods, especially at the time in the timeline we're talking about, which is believed to be in general a drier period. And if you look at both the animals in these areas, the non-human primates, and you also look at humans who live traditionally in Africa, you see that shape-seeking behavior is important. So these authors, writing about water conservation adaptations, wrote that reduced activity during the hottest period of the day is typical of the African hominoids, chimpanzees, gorillas, and savanna-dwelling baboons. In these living primates, foraging behavior peaks in the early to mid-morning and again in the late afternoon. Similar daily activity patterns would probably have been adopted by early hominids. Of course, it's a bit speculative to say what would have been adopted by early hominids, but if we look at what people in these areas who live traditionally now, we see something similar. So in a paper that was recently estimated vitamin D status among the Maasai, who are pastoralists in Africa, and the Hadzabi, who are hunter-gatherers in a similar area, they wrote that the Maasai spend most of their days in the sun wearing clothes that mainly cover their upper body and their upper legs, and that it is important to note that whenever possible, they avoid direct exposure to the sun, prefer a shady place, especially during midday. And of the Hadza, they wrote, they spend most of their days in the sun. Similar to the Maasai tribe, they avoid direct exposure to the fierce sun whenever possible, and most of their activities are planned in the early morning and late afternoon, while spending the middle part of the day sleeping, eating, or talking in a cooler place under a tree or rock. One thing that you can notice from pictures of the Maasai and the Hadza is that they have very dark skin. So if you compare this to the behavior that was described in this original paper that Pete had cited about 25 hydroxyvitamin D concentrations in lifeguards, or if you compare the skin color to pictures that I can find of Israeli lifeguards, you see that the skin color is much lighter. And that in the paper, they wrote, on the job, lifeguards are exposed to heat and intense sunlight over almost their entire body surface for at least 8 hours per day, 6 months per year. So it's more difficult for them to spend 3 or 4 hours in the middle of the afternoon taking a nap or hanging out under a rock because their job requires them to be in the sun. And they have more of their body surface exposed because of what they're wearing. And they are much more naked because they're missing the dark skin pigmentation. If we go back to the data that we've cited, we can also note that this heavily relies on European ancestry. So even though there are Puerto Ricans, they take about 2/3 of their ancestry from Spain, in some estimates, and Israelis, according to some estimates, depending on which subgroup you're talking about, often have ancestry from Europeans as high as 55% according to some estimates. So we should want to look at people who don't have European ancestry. And a recent meta-analysis of 394 studies, including over 33,000 people, found that among Caucasians, which is the slope of this line shown here, all over the world, vitamin D status declines as you get further away from the equator, going right on this graph. But among non-Caucasians, there is essentially a flat line. So this suggests, and so one thing that you can notice then, is that even among non-Caucasians living at the equator, their vitamin D status is still considerably lower than Caucasians living as far north as 45 or 60 degrees latitude. But the other thing that this suggests is that there's something different about vitamin D metabolism in people who are non-Caucasians that should be protoperdic. Of course, this does conflict with some smaller studies showing that when people move from Africa to a place of much higher latitude, that they might have lower vitamin D status. But nevertheless, the fact that over the course of 33,000 people and hundreds of studies, the overall trend doesn't seem to show up seems to indicate that that's not a very robust finding. So if we look at the affected race among people who are exposed to copious amounts of sun, we see that non-whites seem to have lower vitamin D status, even in extremely sun-rich environments like Hawaii. This is a study where university students and skateboarders were approached of different races in Hawaii. They had an average of 22 hours a week exposure to the sun with no sunscreen, with about half their body exposed. And their vitamin D status was, in the mean among the whites, was 37 nanograms per milliliter, considerably lower than those lifeguards. But among Asians, it was 33% lower than that, even though the Asians were also exposed to copious amounts of tropical sun. If we look at rural Indians, who were estimated to have 9 hours a day of exposure of their face, chest, back, arms, and legs, and forearms to the Indian sun, their vitamin D status seems extremely low by our standards, 23.7 nanograms per milliliter in the males and 19 nanograms per milliliter in the females. However, on the other hand, recent studies indicate that among the Maasai and Azabi, pastoralists and hunter-gatherers in Africa, who have very dark skin, their vitamin D status is considerably higher. It's still lower than 65 nanograms per milliliter, like found among lifeguards, but nevertheless, it's much higher than Indians. One way to reduce the variation among all these studies is to account for the different methods that were used to measure vitamin D status. In this chart, I've made an adjustment to compare the values to those made with the DSRN brand radioamino assay, not because it's necessarily more accurate, but simply because it's the most popular one in the literature. So the adjusted values are not necessarily more accurate, but they're more, we can more easily compare them between studies. And this brings Hawaiian Asian 25-hydroxyvitamin D from 25 to 32 nanograms per milliliter, but it brings the Maasai and the Hadabi down to 33 and 37 nanograms per milliliter. So this seems to indicate that with the exception of the Indians, the non-white vitamin D status in very sun-rich environments is between 30 and 40 nanograms per milliliter on average, which is considerably lower than the estimation based on lifeguards and even Puerto Rican farmers. In order to really interpret these data well, though, we have to understand a little bit of something about vitamin D metabolism. So vitamin D is consumed. The liver converts it to 25-OHD, which is what's measured in the blood, which is activated in the kidney to calcitriol. And calcitriol increases calcium by taking it out of the bones and increasing its absorption from food. So we can draw several conclusions. One, because the conversion to calcitriol is very tightly regulated, and the conversion of vitamin D to 25-hydroxyvitamin D is less regulated, it's thought that calcidiol, or 25-OHD, is the best marker of vitamin D nutritional status, because vitamin D quickly disappears, and calcitriol tends to remain the same all the time. Now, you might wonder why, if the activated form tends to remain more or less the same all the time, why do we really care how much 25-OHD we have in supply? There are two reasons for that. One is that optimal 25-OHD levels suppress the need for parathyroid to induce this conversion. Because parathyroid, when our calcium level is low, basically tells the kidney to make more calcitriol. So if you increase the raw material to make this reaction, you need less of the signal to tell the enzyme to do its job. But one other point that tends to be overlooked is that calcitriol is about 1,000 times more active than 25-OHD, but it's not the exclusively active form. And 25-OHD is found at about 1,000 times greater concentration. So really, both of these are probably biologically active. Dietary calcium would be expected to spare this conversion, because if we have more calcium, we don't need as much calcitriol to tell the bone or the intestines to bring more into the blood. There are also other factors, like vitamin A, that's been shown to increase the supply of calcidiol into the kidney to make this conversion. And also inflammation and cancer, for example, increase the rate of this conversion. And then finally, there can be genetic variations in any part of this pathway. So some key things to note about this is that 25-hydroxyvitamin D does increase with a greater input of vitamin D, but it could also reflect dietary vitamin A. It could also reflect dietary calcium. It could also reflect genetics. It could also reflect inflammation or cancer, any of these processes. And because of the different reasons 25-OHD can be low, we can't assume that low is always worse and high is always better. Because if we are not eating very much calcium, we're going to have less 25-OHD because it's being converted into calcitriol. But that's increasing the demand for it. if vitamin D is helping us independently make this, I mean, vitamin A is helping us independently make this conversion, we're increasing the supply of it instead of increasing the demand for it. Likewise, there could be genetic variations that decrease our ability to produce 25-OHD in the first place that may be essentially causing a deficiency of it. But there could also be genetic variations making this conversion more likely, which is basically increasing the biological activity. So without knowing why the 25-OHD is low, we can't really say that it's because vitamin D is deficient. So if we go on to look at rat studies show that decreasing calcium to a deficient level is decreases 25-OHD by 61%. There are randomized controlled trials that are negative in humans. Overall, it's been under research. But there is one study that seemed to indicate that in a placebo group versus calcium alone, the number of people jumped from 0% to 23% who had sufficient 25-OHD levels. It wasn't statistically significant, but it may be a hint that if we studied this in more detail, we may find the real effect of calcium. If we look at Indians, the Indians, as we looked at before, had very low intakes of calcium, below 300 milligrams per day. And if you stratified them based on low, middle, and high 25-OHD levels, calcium was higher in people with better vitamin D status, and the phytate to calcium ratio was lower. Phytate is an anti-nutrient that decreases calcium absorption. So Indians may be the outlier simply because the calcium level in their diet is so low, especially compared to groups like the Maasai who drink milk and the Hadza who eat very calcium-rich plant foods. If we look at genetics, we see a number of genetics genes that are listed here. I won't go into detail with all the different levels of the metabolism cascade. One I'd like to focus in on quickly is the enzyme that converts 25-OHD to calcitriol. If we look at the yellow, we see that African Americans have much greater proportion of this gene that decreases their 25-OHD by 36%. It has no effect in whites. And that seems to indicate that African Americans may have genes that increase the supply of calcitriol. So I'm going to skip ahead really quickly through this conclusion because I underestimated the time this is going to take.
We have 4 minutes for Q&A.
I'll have to do that. So if we look at blacks versus white, we see that whites, they have lower 25-OHD, but they also have higher bone mineral density, which has been a conundrum. Why do blacks seem to have deficiency of vitamin D, but better bone status? But if we look at calcitriol, it's higher, and there's no difference in parathyroid hormone, which seems to indicate that they respond better, perhaps to their lower intake of calcium, which is well established, than whites do, to make calcitriol without increasing parathyroid hormone. And this may indicate why they have better bone status. That could indicate that the physiologically normal 25-OHD is lower for blacks than it is for whites, because they have a more robust activation of vitamin D. Similar evidence is found in the Inuit. Here, the gene hasn't been identified, but if you look at Inuit on a Western diet and compare them to Danes, they have lower 25-OHD, and this is restored by eating their marine-rich diet. However, they also have higher calcitriol and lower parathyroid hormone, which means they have a more robust activation of 25-OHD to the active form, which lowers 25-OHD, but it increases biological activity, suggesting that their normal 25-OHD is lower. So if we look at the naked ape hypothesis, we can say that it seems we're not naked. We were never naked apes because we had dark skin, clothing, potentially body paints, and botanical sunscreens. That lifeguards aren't a good proxy because they have different skin color, different sun exposure, and different genetic vitamin D metabolism. That the idea of a proxy for paleo 25-OHD is fundamentally flawed because the climate may have been different. And then finally, the idea that there was ever a fixation of vitamin D requirements is fundamentally flawed because we see genetic variation today, which means the vitamin D requirement has continued to change for different people. But the most damning evidence that using these lifeguards in Israel is a good marker of optimal 25-hydroxyvitamin D status is that the title of the paper the data was drawn from is titled Increased Incidence of Nephrolithiasis, which means kidney stones, in lifeguards in Israel, showing that although they had twice the 25-OHD as the regular population, they had 12 to 20-fold the incidence of kidney stones. This is consistent with other evidence that vitamin D promotes soft tissue calcification in excess in general, even at levels that don't necessarily cause hypercalcemia, as is often assumed, and this could also contribute to heart disease. The most concerning evidence, however, is a randomized placebo-controlled trial showing that 400 IU of vitamin D and 1,000 milligrams of calcium did not reduce the risk of hip fracture, but increased the risk of kidney stones by 17%. So my conclusion from this, that I don't really have time to go into my talk, but I have plenty of writings on this that are available in Wise Traditions and on my blog, is that one of the ways we can reconcile the finding that vitamin D, even at potentially low levels, it's a potential to contribute to soft tissue calcification, is that it's not about how much vitamin D is harmful and how much vitamin D is good, but it's about getting vitamin A from organ meats, vitamin D from sunshine, both from cod liver oil, and vitamin K, 1 and K2 from leafy greens, animal fats, and fermented foods altogether. And this protects against soft tissue calcification by promoting the expression and activation of vitamin K-dependent proteins that are needed to protect against soft tissue calcification. And then when you get one fat-soluble vitamin and not the other, you contribute to an imbalance that dysregulates those proteins. So really quick summary, if there is an ancestral 25-OHD, there's better precedent for 30 to 40 nanograms per milliliter if you use the diazoran assay, slightly different results with different assays, rather than 40 to 60 or 40 to 80. However, in both clinical practice and research, we need to measure calcitriol in order to better understand why 25-OHD is low or high, and we need to take into account interactions with other fat-soluble vitamins and calcium. We also need to look at ancestry, both in clinical practice and research. And if we look at these nutrient interactions, they imply that there's no such thing as an optimal 25-OHD, but there's an optimal nutritional balance between the different nutrients. And then finally, we really need research and clinical practice to focus less on this idea of optimal 25-OHD and more on the total nutrient density of the diet and on nutritional balance. And in the process, we have a wonderful life with plenty of outdoor sunshine and plenty of very delicious foods. So thank you very much.